Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. We've been working closely together now for a couple of months, and it's fantastic to see the progress that's already been made, and a lot of it would be not possible without your help. So it really is awesome to get you on. And for those listening who don't know Michael, he is the producer of the Jake Woodhouse podcast and works in tandem with Pat, who was on the podcast recently. So it's pretty cool to see what we're building, and thank you for joining, Michael. Let me start. I'm going to keep it cash. I actually want to talk about Vietnam. So you grew up in the States, but you live in Vietnam, or you travel there a lot. And we were just joking. My wife spent 4 years in Ho Chi Minh. I know Vietnam pretty well as a result. It's an awesome place. How come you decided to spend time in Vietnam?
It's a good question. I had been working in like circa corporate America for about 5 years after graduation. And I had heard about the idea of being like a digital nomad and traveling and working remotely. And when that became a possibility, because I changed jobs, which maybe we can get into.
Yeah, well, we will.
I was looking at a few different places, and Bali was one of them. I went there initially, and I really liked Bali. But there was a city in Vietnam called Da Nang that seemed to have as high of a quality of life, cost of living ratio as I could find. Mm. So that was the main focus. You know, I think as Bitcoiners, which obviously we both are, a huge priority for me has been to prioritize my health and then, of course, stack sats. And I viewed this as kind of a way to arbitrage money in a few different ways, which is earn dollars, spend Vietnamese dong, and then save in Bitcoin in the meantime. And it's a pretty good deal, really. I have no complaints.
Awesome. And so how did you calculate that? If you're thinking about places to go and you're obviously at a certain period in your life where actually you have more freedom and you don't have as much responsibility. So those are the moments you've got to seize them. You've got to take them and go. But like, what are there websites you can find that show the cost of living? Like, or was it just a case of speak to some people? I hear this is a good place.
I think a combination of both. There is a website called nomads.com where I think you can even become a member, which I'm not, but they basically rank. They have a list of a top 100 cities to go and work abroad in. And they rank them based on weather and air quality, cost of living, nightlife, basically whatever you're into. If you want to find the beach, if you want to find outdoor activities, hiking, nature, they rank order all of these different locations based on whatever you want to prioritize. And that's where I was looking initially. And Da Nang was towards the top for a few of the things that were priorities for me.
Cool. I never made it to Da Nang. I spent most time in Ho Chi Minh. I also did a trip to Hanoi, and we took motocross bikes. We actually drove right the way up to the Chinese border and back. We did an amazing motorbike trip in the north. Vietnam is such a cool place, and you can get to places in the country where actually there's just, you know, there's not a lot of tourism at all. And it feels like stepping back in time in some way. Some of the valleys that we drove through, there was true, well, to me anyway, like cultural traditions still being held, like in the kind of very edge of the Himalayas in North Vietnam. It's absolutely crazy. I love visiting there. So what are some of the highlights for you of actually being able to live somewhere like Vietnam? You get off a call with me sitting in Australia, or shout out to Robert. You're also the producer of the What Is Money show. You know, you're finishing what might be like high intense work looking at the future of money, and suddenly you walk out onto the street and you're in Vietnam. It must be such a difference.
Yeah, it is a trip sometimes. I will say that one of the things that I was really prioritizing when selecting a place to go was to automate as best as I could all of the areas of my life that I felt like were holding me back when I was living in Los Angeles. Mm. And these are just things that first and foremost, things like commuting to an office. This was like a real drain on my physical health, mental health in certain ways. And even as small as things like having to cook 3 meals a day and having to do laundry and clean and do all of these things. So one of the huge benefits to being here is that many of these things I can just pay somebody else to do. I'm able to cut out things in my life that were holding me back previously due to, you know, my own lack of discipline or any number of reasons. But it's been very helpful in that I feel like I've been able to really lock in on my work in a way that I wasn't able to before, because I'm able to cut out previous vices and distractions and things that were negatives in my life.
Mm. Cool. No, I'm a big fan of making bold moves like that and moving to different parts of the world, trying new things. And well, we probably wouldn't be having this call if you weren't already a predisposition to that. A, curious, but it's not just about being curious. It's actually having the balls to go and do it. Like, a lot of people would just sit at home and be like, oh, wouldn't that be a cool thing to think about doing, but never actually book a ticket and fly there. And so are there lots of other digital nomads sitting in Da Nang that you've met? And is there like a local Bitcoin meetup, for example? I know when I went to the Indonesian Bitcoin conference 18 months ago, there was a whole community of Vietnamese Bitcoiners that were there. So I'm sure you've probably met some over the last, you've been there for a year or two now, haven't you?
About 6 months at this point, six months. Not as much of a Bitcoin community as there was. Sorry, what's that?
I thought it was longer, I must say. Okay, yeah, 6 months. Yeah.
The end of last year was when I got here first. And then I came home for Christmas, came back. So about 6 months in total. In Bali, when I was there, there was a very strong Bitcoin meetup community. And I'm still a part of the group chats and messages and things like this. I haven't found something like this here. And to be fair, I haven't looked that hard, but I have met a number of Bitcoiners. Even just the other day, I was walking along the beach and I saw a guy with a Bitcoin shirt on. And of course, we strike into an hour-long conversation. So I have met other Bitcoiners. I have made some local Vietnamese friends, and I've set them up with a little moon wallet and sent them some Bitcoin. I did that when I was here the first time, and Bitcoin was at, I think, 60 or so thousand. And they have been, you know, it's crazy for them to open up their little wallet app at this point and see that the number has gone up so much, and they are, you know, they're thrilled. They have their questions, and it's been a nice way to introduce some people to it, for sure.
I'll have to dig up the people that I met that are based there and send them to you. And so, Michael, I mean, there's so many different directions we could take this in, but I think this is a cool way, which is that basically Bitcoin's completely global, right? Okay, yes, you saw some people on the beach or whatever, and you can start talking to them. But the idea that there's digitally native money, that means that you can take your physical being and you can sit it anywhere and plug it into the internet and earn hard currency. This wasn't ever possible before. Why does that get you excited?
Some of the things that excite me. Well, I think that being in a country like Vietnam, I think that the problems that people have using broken money are even more obvious than in my home of America. The idea of saving here is very foreign. People earn money and spend it almost as fast as they earn it. And I think that, you know, when I was speaking with my Vietnamese friend, and I was encouraging him to, he wanted to sell the Bitcoin after it went up. And I was encouraging him to, you know, hold on to it and kind of see where it goes. And many of them have so many expenses and issues in their day-to-day life that conceptualizing the future and thinking about, you know, themselves and their families 1 to 10 years from now is really difficult to do. And I think that that's in large part due to the fact that it's really difficult to save here. Mm. And that distorts how much we're able to plan for the future, which is a huge negative for not only, you know, the society at large, but the individuals that make up that society. It's really, if you're not able to lower your time preference and plan for the future, it's difficult to improve your life.
And the local currency is Vietnamese dong.
Yes.
Is that pegged to the US dollar, or is it inflating even
That's
faster?
A good question. I'm not sure how this works here.
And I don't know either. We'll have to look it up. Because it's when I did Bitcoin with Jake, I spoke to people in all sorts of different parts of the world. And one of the fascinating experiences of that was the product market fit for Bitcoin is strongest in places with the worst financial services. So I spoke with a guy in Guatemala. I spoke with a guy in Kenya. I spoke with someone who grew up in Togo. I spoke with someone who grew up in Venezuela. They don't need to be sold the benefits of Bitcoin. Like, it just, it works, and it's not controlled by the government, and it doesn't get stolen from you, and it grows in value over time. Okay, how do I use it?
Right.
At least that seemed to be the rhetoric I got from them. Would you say that's true on the streets of Vietnam? And actually, what you've highlighted kind of says it's hard to even have that conversation because of the speed that money's coming in and going out.
Yeah, I actually saw a decent amount of parallels to my friends and family at home when trying to speak with them about Bitcoin. I think that so many people are bogged down in their day-to-day lives with the many problems that they have, and they need to go to work, and they need to, you know, do this and do that, that it tires them out. And it becomes really difficult to take a step back and ask a crazy question like, what is money? You know, it's like, all right, here, I need you to find the energy to do 1,000 hours of research and read all these crazy books and watch all these crazy podcasts. And I feel like I've gotten more and more empathy for how difficult that would be when you're getting pulled a million different directions with work and friends and family and all of the headaches that come with, you know, living life in general. And I think that that has been mostly my experience here as well. I think people are very distracted, and it's difficult to slow down and find the time and energy to dig into, you know, dense topics like this. But the initial value prop, I think, is very clear. It's just a matter of really having that sink in for people, which, you know, just takes time. It takes time and effort.
And it will slowly happen. Well, the more I look at Bitcoin, the more inevitable I think it is. It's fun also to speak very much from a kind of primary research perspective. So, like, how do you feel, Michael, now versus maybe 5 years ago? And how big a part of that is Bitcoin?
I think one of the number one things I learned getting deeper into Bitcoin was that no one was coming to save me. And I remember when I was working at my previous job, and we would have our quarterly or, you know, twice a year meeting with our financial advisor. And he would come in and he would tell us, you give us whatever, 10% of your salary at the end of every month, and in 40 years, you're going to be a millionaire. Like, don't worry, we got it. We're on your side here. And the more that I studied Bitcoin, the more that I looked into Bitcoin, I realized that you have to take personal responsibility. And I think that this, you know, it's strange how those of us within Bitcoin, it's no shock to hear that somebody adopts Bitcoin and they become closer with God or healthier or all of these different things. But it's strange looking at that from the outside. But I think maybe the driving force there is that you realize that no one's coming to save you, and you need to take responsibility for your actions. And if you want to change your life, then you need to actually change your actions. So I think that, yeah, adopting Bitcoin made me take responsibility and take risks and trust myself and live with the result. Hmm.
And even that last phrase has really got me, live with the result. Some people aren't willing to do that. Government, come help me out. The amount of different types of scenarios I come across all the time where it's like, oh, the government should do this, oh, the government should do that. It's like, why? And it's people thinking that the government can actually do that. Mm-hmm. Yet everywhere else I look, I see repeated patterns of, like, basically overspending, under-delivering with little accountability, which are pretty much all due to the fact they can just print their own money. They don't need to be accountable. They don't need to deliver. And they can spend as much as they want.
There's no creative destruction. You know, bad ideas need to fail. And if you have a money printer, you can just keep funding your bad ideas and keep funding your inefficiency. And there's no consequences for irresponsible action. And I think that, I mean, that's how you get governments that look like we got in America and Australia these days.
It's crazy. And so do you still use the financial advisor that you had in mind when you told me that story just now?
Oh, no. In fact, kind of a funny story.
They got sacked.
Well, yeah. I, as far as I know, he's still working with my previous company. But right. I remember on the call, he ended with asking if anybody had any questions. And I posed the classic Jeff Booth price of tomorrow question to him, which is that if technology drives prices down, you know, we have refrigerators and phones and laptops and lights and things that we couldn't have imagined 100 years ago. If technology drives prices down, why are prices going up? And I just left it at that. I left it open-ended. And I remember he rambled on for maybe 10 minutes and threw a bunch of financial jargon out there. And I don't think that he had ever thought about the question. You know,
it's okay to say you don't know.
Yeah, right. Well, to be fair, it's not like, you know, I had it all figured out, that's for sure. But I remember trying to, and I had spoken with Bitcoin with all of my work colleagues for a few years at this point. I was giving it away at our White Elephant gift exchange at Christmas. I remember giving away 177,000 sats when Bitcoin was at 16K in December of 2022. Wow. As my like White Elephant gift. So that they all knew what I was doing and getting at. But yeah, I certainly don't use a financial advisor anymore. I guess Satoshi is my financial advisor at this point.
Mm, and amen to that. Savings technology means you don't need a financial advisor. You know, it's a simple truth, right? And for that reason, the finance industry will look so different in the years to come. Like right now, it's quite obvious it's become far too bloated and all these different layers of fee-taking mechanisms that actually don't create purchasing power. And it's a complete monster, to be honest. Without going completely down that hole, what I'd like to also spend a little time on is, I know in particular, you mentioned the word health. So what does that mean to you, Michael? And like, where were you and where have you got to in relation to health?
You know, I feel like at one point in my life, I was living very reactively. I don't know if that's the right word, but things were happening to me. And I feel like I was almost I wasn't in control of my time during the day. You know, I was working a job that I didn't love. And at night, I feel like I would grab whatever control I had. That's like, I'm going to watch this brain rot content and eat some shitty food. And it's like, okay, all right. That, you know, this is at least a decision I'm making for myself. Yeah, right, yeah. Right. And of course, you wake up the next day and that, you know, that doesn't feel so good.
And do it all over again.
Yeah, yeah, right. I'm never doing that again until tomorrow, basically. And your original question was, how is this?
Well, you mentioned health, and I'm just intrigued as to what that means to you.
Yeah, I think it is. Well, it's multifaceted, and I think for me, and this is different for different people. The mental health and physical health, I feel like they're reliant on one another. So when I feel like, you know, if I'm feeling a bit sad one day or whatever, the solution to me is not to like think my way out of this. It's not to sit down and like, I'm going to solve this problem within my head. It's to get out of my head. Go for a walk outside, you know, go work out, and vice versa. You know, if I'm not motivated to work out, there's probably something, some sort of distraction that I need to sit down with and maybe write some thoughts down and work out in one way or another. So I think those two things are very closely tied together. And the one that I think I naturally come back to is the physical health side of things. Because when I feel like I am working out, getting sufficient sun, eating real food, walking outside with my feet on the ground, it is everything else downstream of that seems to work itself out really.
And you mentioned a few times your kind of previous job. So this is slightly, it's not a trick question, but I already kind of know the answer and I should probably give this history in a sense. We first met through Bitcoin Mentor. So shout out to the guys building Bitcoin Mentor. And I was hosting the Bitcoin Mentor podcast when it started. And you've already told me this story once before, but I think it's fun to go through again. But you weren't feeling all that great when you were working in the job you're referring to. So perhaps you spend a little time just teaching us what that job was and what you were doing and how you felt at the time.
Yeah, I studied stats and finance in college, and I got a job at a consulting firm after graduating. And I was working in the like logistics arena. I was working with companies like Amazon and Walmart to build out and optimize their big storage facilities. So all the stuff that we order online, you know, it's stored in a warehouse somewhere and it's organized in a certain manner. And there's a number of different rules and regulations that they need to follow in order to do this. So I was working on the side of the companies, helping them permit and follow all these rules and regulations. And well, you know, it almost felt like one of those fake jobs to a certain degree. You know, it's like this job exists because some bureaucrat somewhere, I don't know, has made up some random rules that we all have to follow. And a certain amount of it is necessary, of course. It's not just complete anarchy. But, you know, long hours generally and a lot of time spent inside. And I think that my brain works best when I'm moving around And, you know, even when I'm working on our show or the What Is Money show or with Bitcoin Mentor, I'm like constantly moving around and walking. And that has been kind of freeing myself from the office environment and giving myself the ability to like work in a way that's conducive to my natural tendencies has been very helpful. I guess tying it full circle, when you're doing something that you don't love, and I also at this time had started going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and I remember being deeply discouraged by the fact that I was spending all of my time and energy each day working for something else that another guy was going to print out of thin air. And that was very demotivating, you know, because it felt like I was chasing after something, whether it was buying a home or buying a new car, whatever it might be, or retirement, whatever. I was chasing after these things, but they were getting further away from me faster than I was gaining on them. So, you know, I think that this is pretty universal, you know, maybe not many people can articulate it. And I certainly couldn't at the time. But when you're working and exchanging your time and energy for something else that somebody can print out of thin air, how does that not just cripple your spirit almost? You know, that's like, even if you don't really know what's happening, I think that intuitively you can feel it. And yeah, I think that's the situation for a lot of people, which is, you know, really horrible.
I mean, yes, I agree. It's hard when you suddenly start to ask these questions. Like, well, hang on a second. What is money being the top of the line? But, you know, in your stats and finance degree, did you ever ask the question, what is money?
Oh, it didn't even cross my mind.
No. And it's not in any of the content. And I did a business management degree as well. And the what is money question is not in there, right? It's all, in hindsight, heavily biased, Keynesian funded. It's an ideology. Mm-hmm. And they can pay for it themselves to pump it out through the universities. And the more you start thinking about it, like, hang on, what is going on here? If you can print your own money and do it at such scale that some people don't quite notice the inflation, and therefore you can keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. I mean, like, what is a trillion? Like, a trillion is such a gargantuan size. It's hard to comprehend how big that is. Yet at the same time, it's like, well, what would you do with that? Well, you'd spend it on things you want. And obviously, creating a perpetual cycle of more and more people that believe this is actually good for them is one way of continuing to get richer and richer and richer. And it makes sense. And you're like, oh, well, the incentive is obviously teach them that it's good for them.
Right.
And you never ask that. So I've often said that in my lifetime, until I really came across Bitcoin, I was highly trained in how to make money, but never ask the question, what is money? And that was a far, far more useful economic question than anything else I'd ever asked. And I mean, here we are today, essentially making podcasts, yeah, Talk about Bitcoin, investing in things, be like, whoa.
Well, I remember when the question, I forget exactly how I had come across it, maybe with one of my friends who we kind of went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole together. But I remember us at the time thinking, like, we have been in school for 17, 18 years of our life. And how did this never come up? Nobody thought to pose this question.
Yeah, hello? It almost felt
like, yeah, right. It's like, boy, you know, it seems like that might've been an important one to talk about a little bit. But, you know, I think it's why when you start asking it and you find that question, you go so hard down the rabbit hole because it feels like somebody doesn't want you to be asking that question. It's like, why do none of us even, you know, why are none of us paying attention to that?
It's hard to stop going down it because everything starts making more sense. So as someone who's done, you know, I did statistics at degree level, I just scraped through the module. But like, okay, there are some parts of obviously mathematics that's actually useful. But there's a lot of mathematics that I studied that's completely useless. And it's like, why would I have even bothered spending time doing that? The same applies for different parts of macro and microeconomics, which is actually far worse than the mathematics. At least the mathematics is grounded in some kind of reality. This stuff is like, I remember looking at these crazy formulas about, and you're like, what is this shit?
Yeah.
And suddenly like, oh, go and buy Safe Dean's book, what is it called?
Bitcoin Standard or Fiat Money?
Well, that, and then he's got the economics textbook as well.
Principles of Economics.
Principles of Economics. Thank you, Michael. And you're just like, oh my God, boom, 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 boom. You're like, well, this is the best economics book I've ever read in my life.
Yeah.
Now I walk around and everything starts to make more sense. It's like, that's why the rabbit hole is so compelling, because it's like, oh, well, that makes sense. Okay, well, what else makes sense? And you just keep going, keep going, keep going. You're like, oh, well, my degree was a waste of time. I shouldn't get paid in dollars. I definitely don't eat the right stuff. I spend my time doing things that are for other people, not for myself. And half my shit's taken off me every year without really any, you know, oops, I paid tax in every single area of my life. And it's, yeah, it's a crazy rabbit hole, isn't it? Oh my gosh. What would be fun here actually, Mike, is beforehand, we're obviously talking about a few things we wanted to discuss today. And you brought up the Broken Money by Lynn Alden and some of the earlier chapters of that book. So what was it about that you wanted to discuss with me?
Well, I've spent a lot of time trying to orange pill friends and family and just people generally. And I have settled on that book as I think the best one to hand over to somebody to, you know, it doesn't speak about Bitcoin very much, but it speaks a lot about what money is. Mm. And I remember the first chapter just really, really sticking with me. And she explained that part of what makes humans unique from other animals is our ability to cooperate at scale. And that's through things like language and money in the same way. If you even just, if we think back to maybe a dumb example, if you're alone on an island by yourself, there's no need for money. You know, you have nobody to trade with, you have nobody to coordinate with. And if maybe you're joined by a second person, maybe you guys just keep like a mental ledger of, you know, this morning I got up and went fishing for food. Maybe tomorrow you go do that for me. And, you know, that mental ledger might work with just a couple people. And then if you scale that up to like 100 people, maybe you want to start writing down, you know, which favors are owed to who. Like, you know, I did this for you, you owe me this. And the book even mentions that the earliest form of writing that we have on record was from Mesopotamia. And it was a clay tablet from about 5,000 years ago that was just a ledger of X person owes one cow to Y person. And, you know, it even makes you think that maybe we started writing things down because we needed a form of money at the time. So money almost predates writing. And well, if we keep going with our example here, with 100 people, maybe that written ledger is a fine way of keeping track of who owes, you know, what to whom. But as soon as we start interacting with people that we don't know and don't trust, maybe we start encountering neighboring tribes or, you know, other civilizations completely. We needed a way to trade with them when we didn't trust them, we didn't know them, and we may never see them again. And what the book goes into is that the initial attempt at trading with them was barter. You know, maybe I have extra spears, you have extra furs. And as long as that, well, what's called the double coincidence of wants is satisfied, which means that we both coincidentally want what the other person has in excess of, then we can trade, no problem. But as soon as that double coincidence of wants isn't satisfied, so let's say I go to trade with somebody else and they already have enough spears, then the trades are going to fail, and they're going to fail a lot more than they're going to succeed. So basically, we can scale trade within small groups by just keeping a mental ledger, writing things down. But as soon as we start dealing with people that we don't know and don't trust, this problem of barter comes into play, where it's difficult to complete trades with one another. And Lynn Alden speaks about one of the earliest forms of money being shells. And people started collecting shells and using them in trade for items like spears. And a question that really struck me was basically, how could a shell have more value than something like a spear or something like food? You can eat food. You need food to eat. A spear, you can actually do something with it. You can hunt. And these things provide actual utility. And what she explained so brilliantly is that past a certain point, more spears aren't helpful. You know, if we have 100 people in our group, we don't need 1,000 spears. They just become a burden at that point. They're too much to carry around. They're almost a negative at that point. And food is similar. You know, there's no refrigeration at this time. So how much food do you really need? Well, as much as you need before it's going to spoil. So you don't need a year's worth of food because it's rotting. So people started collecting shells, and these specific shells, they were only found very in deep parts of the ocean. So there was some effort involved in diving down and polishing them and making them look pretty. And people started using these shells as one side of every trade. We have these oral or, you know, mental ledgers and then written ledgers. The shells are really just a ledger. And the ledger is updated by physical possession of the shell. So those who hold the shells are the ones that control the ledger. And each of those shells can basically be viewed as like a little stored up favor. You know, like initially with just the two people on the island, you owed me one. And each of those shells basically represents like, hey, you owe me one. And why it's a question that I had initially was why something like shells. And there's an entire study called Austrian Economics, of course, which you're very familiar with, which basically breaks down why something becomes money. And what people were looking for was just the most sellable object, you know, the thing that everybody else wanted, the easiest item to sell. And shells happened to be very sellable because they were very durable. They weren't going to rot like the food. They were very portable in that you could sew them into your clothes. You could wear them as a necklace or as jewelry. And they were, you know, scarce, portable, durable. And like I referenced earlier, past a certain point, more food, more spears becomes an actual burden for you because you have no use for it. So these shells basically represented a way of storing up like a little financial battery, basically. It was like this little favor that you could store, and you didn't need to cash it in for something that you needed right away. You could store it in the future and you could trade it for something whenever you needed something. It's like, okay, I don't need food today, but maybe in 1 month I can take these little shells and trade them for that. So the big idea here being that money is really just a ledger. Initially just an oral ledger, then we start writing stuff down, and then we start trading these little physical objects like, you know, gold, shells, things like this that have certain properties. And it helps us scale trade with people that we don't know, don't trust, and may never see again. And that's like, you know, it's incredibly useful, of course. It's what lets us specialize at things, which is, you know, if you look around you, basically all of the stuff in your apartment is because we have been able to, the division of labor, really, we're able to specialize at things. And, you know, like tonight, I'm gonna work on our podcast a little bit, and I can't go down to the store and say, hey, listen, I just did some work on a podcast. Can I have some food? It's like, they don't care. I do some work for you. You give me money. I take the money and trade it for the food that I want, and they can take the money and trade it for whatever else that they may need in the future. So money, you know, I don't know the store owner here. I don't trust him. He doesn't trust me. But we're able to trade and coordinate with one another because of this thing called money, which is, it's just fascinating to me, really.
Just to really hammer that, like, the Bitcoin rabbit hole is so compelling. It shouldn't really be called the Bitcoin rabbit hole. It should be called the money rabbit hole. And it's like, oh, I'm learning about what money actually is for the first time. And by going through the history of money, it helps to just really make it so clear. It's like, oh, it's this thing that sits in between everything else that kind of greases the wheels of trade. And what comes up for me is it's like saving and investing are not the same thing. And the reason they're not the same thing is because you can save with just money. And so you collect your seashells, or you collect your gold, or you collect now your Bitcoin, and you just sit with this on your balance sheet, on your person, however the particular money that you use is best ported. And that's not making an investment. That's saving in money. Mm-hmm. And so it helps you to really just go, okay, hang on. So if I buy a house, or if I own a part of a company, or I own some debt that could be a government or a company, or I have a classic car, or I have some artwork, like these are all other asset classes outside of money. And the way that the traditional investment market has now been built on the last 100 years of central banking is such that there's very little like differentiation. You know, if you put your money, which we're told is, you know, an Aussie dollar or a British pound or a US dollar, you're supposed to use a bank local to your geography, and they basically can't really give you much of an interest rate, because until, well, relatively recently we had zero interest rates, and now it's like, oh, you might get 5% interest rate in the bank, but the real rate of inflation is actually like maybe 10 or 15%. So you're still net negative in purchasing power. And actually, there's massive counterparty risk because you're putting your stuff in someone else's balance sheet that they then take on as a liability in loans. And they do it at like 10x, right? With fractional reserve banking. It's a mess, right? And it's only possible to really see that for what it is by looking at the history of money. And you go, oh, it's something completely separate. And we did business management and finance degrees. We didn't even look at that. Like, and even today, shout out to my accountant that helps me. I'm like finishing up a really great call. We've run through a whole bunch of different stuff I'm working on. And I'm like, so how are you getting on? You know, do you need any help with Bitcoin? Are you going to maybe buy some? And he's seen some of the things I've been working on going very well. Literally my accountant. And he starts asking me about Ethereum. And I'm like, okay, I'll tell you. I would first focus on Bitcoin and then leave all the other altcoins until you figured out what Bitcoin is first. And the point is, even highly trained, excellent, you know, accountants and tax advisors don't have a clue what money actually is.
Yeah. And, you know, as a little extension to that, these days when people ask me about whatever Ethereum, XRP, I just tell them to look at Fartcoin. That is like, I say, listen, you should check out Bitcoin and then maybe take a look at Fartcoin as well. I think that it's funny because I think it has as much utility as any of them. And it's just so perfectly named that I think it kind of like disarms them a little bit. It's like, listen, no. I'm telling you, the future is Fartcoin, man. Wow. And, you know, I think Fartcoin's as good as ETH and XRP at this point. So, you know, alpha for everybody out there.
To me, it is. I'd love to stay on this kind of broken money idea, though, because the other thing that the early stages of that book helped me understand was the idea of debt. And so you're right. Like, there's, you know, you go from being one person on an island to two people on an island. And okay, let's say it's you and I. And I wake up today, I was like, mate, I'm going for a fish. Come back home, give you half my fish. Tomorrow I wake up, I'm like, mate, you got to go fishing today. But that's like, that's in some ways, you're in my debt because I gave you some food. And what I really enjoyed about studying that was like these. When we lived in small tribes and the global population of humans is very, very small, you'd have basically your direct family surrounding you your whole life. And in that environment, you're actually able to basically remember what everyone owes you and you owe them. And therefore, you didn't necessarily need money. So credit predates money. Mm-hmm. And that's actually like, oh, okay. And so some of the discussions I see going on at the moment about, oh, well, what happens when we live on a, you know, hyper Bitcoinized world and a true Bitcoin standard, it's going to be only equity and there'll be no debt. It's like, really? That doesn't make sense when you frame it like that. So I'm still going to owe people for things. It might not be in dollar terms or Bitcoin terms, but it's still going to be like, I owe you a favor or I owe you something. And therefore, I'm absolutely confident that credit products will be created on Bitcoin somehow. What will actually work, we'll have to wait and see. I'm still not actually using any of them because I'm not very confident with some of the problems I see with them. Anything else from early and broken money that resonates?
Well, you know, something that really stuck with me was how shells, for example, or anything that you're using as money, that is going to be a fine system. The shells work just fine until somebody within your group or somebody from another group got more technologically advanced than, well, let's say this, we have one civilization that has a certain level of technology using shells. And then somebody comes across the sea from Europe and they have factories and they have, you know, machines that can manufacture things like shells very, very quickly. And the big problem that people have come across for, you know, really this is like the history of money for thousands of years, is that one form of money like shells works as long as we're all on the same level in terms of our technology. But as soon as somebody gets too advanced, they figure out a way to make and manufacture the thing that everyone else is using as money. And they can be very quiet about this. I thought initially like, okay, you figure out how to make the money, the whole game breaks. But what people did, they were much more clever than that. They would figure out a way to say mass collect these shells that people have to dive down and go pick them up one by one. Maybe they figure out a scuba mask or something. They can go down and get a bunch of them. They can then, instead of polishing them by hand, they can take them back to a factory and have them polished by machines. And they can then take these shells without telling anybody, go back to the civilization using shells and slowly start to buy up all the stuff. They can buy up the homes with the shells and they can buy up the food and the tools. all the stuff that the shells are just a receipt for. And as long as they do this quietly, at least initially, what'll happen is they'll get a ton of the stuff and they'll be dumping all of the inflating shells that of course have no value in and of themselves. They're just a receipt for all the stuff that has value. So basically this shell money game works as long as we're all on the same level technically. But as soon as one group figures out a way to manufacture the thing that's being used as money, then it's, you know, all hell breaks loose. And the shells are obviously going to hyperinflate. They're going to lose all their value. And you need to come up with a new system. And that's why, you know, gold has lasted so long as money is that, I mean, it's an element on the periodic table. It's difficult to make more of it out of thin air. And basically, we're obviously very technologically advanced today. And it's not cost effective to make gold in a lab yet, you know, so gold has really withstood the test of this constant test of technology trying to inflate a money supply away. You know, everyone always has a huge incentive to figure out a way to make more of the thing that we're using as money. And if you're caught holding the bag when a new leap takes forward technologically, then, you know, that's obviously very bad for you. So I think, you know, that's really what we think is happening with Bitcoin here is there's a new technologically superior form of money. And the longer that you hold on to the old shitty money that, you know, we know how to make in a lab, you know, we had to just click a button and print out of thin air, the worse things are going to get for you and your family. So there's some real, like, you know, it's an imperative. It's not really optional. You don't get to opt into this game. Everyone is playing the game by default. If you're using a form of money that somebody else can make out of thin air, you're going to be exploited, plain and simple. And, you know, I think that's why we are so lucky to do what we do, because it's fun to be able to warn people about this coming threat. You know, it's serious stuff, but it's very valuable information. Assuming we're right. And, you know, I know nothing, of course, that's for sure. But
I mean, there's always a possibility we're wrong. That's life, right? You could be wrong at any time about anything. Some things that are resonating for me, though, as you talk through that. First of all, when you make a really simplistic example of the seashells and how the seashell as a form of money can be corrupted, that's what's happening today, mm-hmm. ladies and gents. For the people out there that are listening, you're getting rug pulled every single day because central banks exist. And if you live somewhere that has a central bank, which is everywhere, then you're getting inflated in some ways. And so the first time I heard the phrase inflation is a stealth tax, I was like, what do you mean? It's like, well, basically your purchasing power is being eroded every year by a certain percentage, depending on where you are, which basically acts as another form of taxation by those in power and the government that exists in that geographic zone. And it's mind-blowing how bad it actually is for basically everyone. It's like a net negative. When you really start peeling it back, it's like, well, hang on, who's better off here? And there's a small handful, the very top of the pile, that are basically taking a cut out of everyone else's work. And they don't even realize. That's why it's really fun. Like, you go into my experience, you know, being involved in the investment space, and you get a traditional wealth advisor sit down and take you through a portfolio, and you just say, well, is the purchasing power up or down since last year? Sorry? You know, they don't know how to answer, right? They give you a whole lot of nominal results. It's like, well, hang on, what's the CPI? Our CPI was this. Okay, well, how many times has CPI been changed in the last 50 years since the gold standard was officially ended? Okay, what's actually in the basket of goods that the CPI is comparing it to? Everything I actually want to buy, whether that be like high quality steak, a house, or whatever, you know, quality item might be, it's gone up in price. So you're telling me that this portfolio you're presenting to me is actually increased in purchasing power? Forget it. But they're not incentivized to actually do that. And that's just perpetual. I mean, another great book being When Money Dies. Like, people in Weimar Republic, 1920s Germany, thought they were all getting rich, and they weren't.
Yeah, it's the danger of using something as your denominator that's not stable. You know, So we're looking at, you know, our nominal 401k balance every year and being like, wow, okay, new milestone, I'm so rich. But the thing that you're using to measure it with is changing. It's like an example I've heard a million times before is like, if you're measuring a table with a ruler that's changing, You're not sure if you're measuring the table or the ruler. You know, it's like it's completely nonsensical. And I think that's what we're doing with, you know, a lot of our like net worth calculations and stuff. Where, like you said, people think that they're getting richer, but they need to think one step further and be like, okay, actually, the house got more expensive. The house that I want, it ran further away from me than I made progress towards it this year. So it's, you know, you're not getting richer because it's all relative to the stuff you can buy. Like you were saying, the when you use a form of money that is constantly changing in supply, it's really difficult to make sense of anything. It's difficult to separate signal from noise, I suppose.
Well, and that's what I was really compelling, this idea that we're basically, money is the measuring stick for the language of value. And you're like, whoa, that's quite a profound statement. Like, we could obviously spend 3 or 4 hours kind of digging into that, but it wasn't until I really started looking at that it hit home how important Bitcoin actually is. Oh yeah, and there's so many different directions I'd love to take this in mind, but okay, we've got about 10 minutes or so left, and what I think would be good to run through is like, what do you actually do? And just if you could break down, like, on a kind of task to task basis, what we do as a podcast and where you get involved. And yeah, I think it'd be fun for any audience member listening. Like, it's absolutely possible to, you know, fall in love with Bitcoin and then find jobs in the Bitcoin space. And this is just a great example of one of those. So yeah, what does it mean to produce a podcast?
Yeah, great question. Well, maybe I'll try to talk through it like holistically, just from start to finish.
Yeah, so whatever feels right.
Yeah, you obviously are the point man, you're the front man, and you reach out to people and schedule times to speak with them, and then you conduct those interviews. And then from there, you take the raw files for the interviews and you send them to our editor, Pat, who, like you said, you know, he came on a few episodes ago. You know, he'll have some fun editing this one out for sure. And and then he takes that edited file and he'll upload it. I'll then take that edited file, and my job from there, I view it really as taking what we made and packaging it in a way that it will resonate and be receptive to the largest amount of people possible while remaining accurate in how I'm portraying it. You know, so like, obviously you could every video just talk about how Bitcoin's going to $1 trillion and, you know, you're all going to be rich.
Make people angry or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So I try to take the finished product that we have and then package it, meaning like an appropriate title, appropriate description, appropriate tags, thumbnail, all of these things, and try to put it together in a way that people are going to resonate with it. And then one step further from there, as I'm watching through it, I will try to notice when moments of the podcast strike me, you know, like, wow, okay, that was an important insight. This really resonated with me here. And then I will edit clips of these videos. I'll make them into anywhere between 5, 10, 15 minute clips. And then obviously we'll upload and post these as well with titles that try to really highlight what value the listener is going to get from them. And from there, I'll coordinate with our editor, Pat, who will make up some shorts of those individual clips. So really what we're trying to do is we're trying to basically give people value by starting by needing 1 minute of their attention, and then maybe expanding that to needing 5 minutes of their attention. And then as they grow to trust us more, as they grow to see the value that we're providing with them, then, you know, they're just going to click on the full form episode right up front, no problem. But, you know, even I have struggles if I see a 2-3 hour podcast, even on a topic that I'm really interested in, it feels like a big commitment. So what we try to do is kind of like pick out the parts that really resonate with us, put those forward, and then show people the value that we're providing, and then package it in a way that makes it attractive for them.
Awesome. And thank you for all your help. It's so much more work than I think people realize, actually producing a high quality podcast. And given that we are still in our first 6 months, I'm really pleased with the progress that we've made so far. Not just in terms of the content that's going out, but also as a little team, the three of us working really well together, and it's been a lot of fun already. The final part to that puzzle that I think I'd like to add is that for me, this is very, very long term. So I want to be doing interviews to some variation for the next like 20 years. Now, initially, it's like year one, 3 a week, 1 hour, different guests each time. When a guest can't make it, I'll jump in and do a bit of a riff and see how it goes. But that could become in person, 3 a week, 1 hour. That could become in person, 3 hour long. It can go in lots of different directions, or even just focusing on completely short form, right? I could sit down and write, we could create some leads or some hooks and do lots of 2 minute long videos about Bitcoin stuff. In a way, it's really cool. We're at a very flexible stage to try and like think about what the best way forwards is. But the way that you break an episode down is so cool, because to some people, there'll be 15 minutes of that 1 hour long conversation that's absolute dynamite. But the rest of it is not what they were wanting to listen to. So without the chopping it up, that doesn't happen. And basically, the clip goes out, the medium clip goes out, the long podcast goes out, and you've just got to keep doing it for a long time. Because if someone gets a good bit of content and they start to like your stuff and then it just disappears, then you've wasted all of that traction. And the fun thing for me is I'm starting to see people reach out, which isn't altogether that obvious initially.
Well, it's so cool, because I think what we are trying to build here is something that's so cool about the internet in general is that it lets people from all across the world who think similarly, it lets them connect with one another. Mm. I think what we're trying to build is like having honest, genuine discussions about things that interest us. And I'm certain that there's an audience for that. The last conversation that we put out, which will have been posted already by the time this goes out, was with a listener who listened to the podcast and was like, okay, hey, I have this interesting idea that I want to speak through. And yeah, it's not only the power of podcasting, the power of the internet. And I think what's so cool is that it scales. You know, it's no different doing this for 100 people or 1 million people. You know,
And if enough people were like, oh, click on that link, it would suddenly have 1 million downloads.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's wild. Yeah, I've described it in the past as, or made the analogy. So Bitcoin is a great way of going, okay, now you can be your own bank. Well, in some ways, podcasting is now you can be your own brand. And I'm not necessarily doing this to create a brand, but you can't deny the fact, you know, it's relatively easy as a barrier to entry to start creating content. And that's what it enables you to do, is over time, people, they get to know you and the trust builds. You may have never heard of them, and they'll come to you with a great opportunity because you already feel like they owe you something, even though that wasn't why it was designed. Like people's attention, their ears, it's just extraordinary, the value exchange. Although, interestingly, it's not necessarily for money being a big part of this conversation. So, yeah. So what are some of the things then that do you think we should be working on over the next 6 months? Is it just still a case of like focusing on what we've been doing well, and what are areas that could have gone a bit better?
That's a great question. I think best when in action. So it's really difficult for me to step back sometimes and make a perfect plan, though, you know, worth doing and at least, you know, putting together the best plan that you can. But one thing that I try to do, and I think it's important for everybody to do, is pay attention to what it is that you're doing and what people are resonating with. You know, if one clip or one episode does particularly well, like go back in and look at it and see what could have been the cause of that. And I think that we're doing a number of things very well, which is consistency, which, you know, when posting online, that is like top notch. If you're not posting consistently, if you disappear for months and then come back, the algorithm forgets you largely.
Wow,
so brilliant. I think we're doing a great job of consistently posting. And I think that from episode 41, 42, which was the last one we posted, from zero to that point, I think that we have made a tremendous amount of progress. The quality of the conversation is very high. The clips, both medium and short form, are great. And I think the main thing that we're trying to do really is provide value for listeners. We're trying to give them something that maybe they haven't thought through completely, or ask a question that piques some interest or curiosity for them. And I think as long as we keep doing that, we're on the right track.
Great. And I wholeheartedly agree. And that's where this is about building it in such a way that it doesn't feel like a chore. So in the past, I got caught out, like I got completely burnt out just tweeting too much. I was like, right, I'm going to use a scheduling tool. I'm going to tweet like 10, 20 times a day. I'd sit down twice a week and just write all this stuff that would just come out of me. And I'd then get comments and replies. And it was absolutely mad. I would get like a million impressions in a few weeks, just a bloke with a keyboard. And that's kind of cool. But at the same time, it was like, I was so overwhelmed by it. So how do you respond to 400 comments? You just can't. And so I stopped. And I've tried all manner of different content creation, newsletters and all sorts. But this is where I've settled down, is the kind of longer form podcasting. And with your and Pat's help, I'm able to publish a lot more than I would be able to do on my own. And that's why it's really working so well, I think.
It reminds me of, in a certain way, what I've attempted doing coming to Vietnam, where you can, the things that you don't particularly enjoy doing, yeah, you can pass off to somebody else who maybe does like, yeah, doing those things, you know?
Another thing, I guess, which is helpful for me, at least, when I hear you say all that, is I'm still using, well, the last few years, this is a wider topic, but digital censorship is really, really serious. And getting shadow banned, getting like outright cancelled, it happens all the time on what is the status quo social media platforms, be that Google-controlled stuff. Even old mate Muskie, supposedly the bastion of free speech, like, he will shut you down in seconds if it suits him. And it's one of the reasons I'm such a big proponent for Nostr, is like, actually, this is an audience you keep forever. So, like, you know, shit on that if you can. You can't. There's just not a huge amount of adoption yet. Hopefully, Fishcake is helping me out with Nostr.build, and we're going to get some analytics created, so we'll be able to see how many people are actually viewing our Nostr content versus others. And I think we'll be seriously surprised by how much Nostr content is being consumed. That will come out in a couple of weeks' time, hopefully, when he's updated it. Or he, it could be a she, I don't know, Fishcake on Nostr. I don't know yet. We haven't chatted properly. But I still use Instagram and Twitter and some of these other major platforms for, I almost think of it as like broadcasting our content. But I'm personally not spending much time hanging out there, socializing, so to speak. But when I do get onto Instagram, for example, within a matter of minutes, I'm on something where some guy is just slamming this product down my throat, where he's like, I can get you 10 million views. If I don't get you 10 million views, you get your money back. And before you know it, you've like scheduled a call at a really inconvenient time, regardless of how much it's going to potentially cost you when you get into their funnel even further. And it's all this like hyper, like, intense sales stuff, where basically these ad revenue platforms are just like, they're becoming this just mess of being punched in the face by salespeople. And it's all like coaching and stuff that I don't need. All I need to do is focus on being a dad, sit on my Bitcoin, and host 3 calls a week with people about stuff I find interesting. And that's it. Yet somehow you get dragged in all these different directions, which hopefully, I don't know, it's hard not to do sometimes.
Yeah, that, I think that maybe even tying it full circle back to Bitcoin, I think that's what Bitcoin lets us do, is it lets us control our time, you know, and when you use the right form of money and the things that you want are getting cheaper for you year after year, that is unbelievably freeing. You know, it removes a lot of the, that like primal worry and concern of where am I going to get food tomorrow is just taken care of. And yeah, I mean, the benefits of that are difficult to explain, really. You have to almost experience it to fully understand it.
Absolutely. It's like, oh, okay, hang on. So since I started looking at this thing even more closer than previously, and one is putting more and more energy into like stacking sats, however you might do that, sell things as investors and buy Bitcoin, or, you know, earn it with your expertise, life starts improving. At least in my experience, that's the case. You absolutely have to live it. And with that, you have to take a bit of risk to get to a place that not a lot of people have tried to get. But I think you and I are in complete agreement that it's worth taking that risk.
Well, and it's also worth thinking through that not doing anything is also a risk. It's a risk to not buy Bitcoin. You know, yeah, people are very, very happy to talk about how risky it is to buy Bitcoin. But it's like, I think the huge risk is not buying Bitcoin, you know, like, if, yeah. So I think that it's easy to think about how risky it is to leave a job that you like, but it's less obvious to think through the risks of staying at the job that you don't like. And it's, that doesn't mean that you just get to quit tomorrow. You need to make a plan, and you need to like take small steps and improve, you know, like it, you don't just get to act irresponsibly and rashly. But yeah, I think that people don't properly factor in how risky it is to do what they're doing currently that's not working. Like that's not a good strategy.
That's why I love that phrase, the worst allocation to Bitcoin is zero. Yeah, that's the only one you don't want. Well, Michael, honestly, so an hour's flown by. I'd really like to just share again how incredibly grateful I am for you joining me on this journey, and awesome job today. Thank you so much for your time. Final one is basically, if anyone wants to reach out, how do they get in touch?
Well, thank you for letting me be a part of the journey. It's unbelievable. I frequently find myself being just like, I feel unbelievably blessed and lucky. So that's in large part thanks to you.
Thank you.
Where people can find me, I have an X account. I don't post very much. I think my last tweet was about Fartcoin, full disclosure. Mike Sutherland 5, I can link that in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll
and then you also mentioned that I work for Bitcoin Mentor,
yes,
which helps people. We help people set up Bitcoin wallets. We help if you have bought some Bitcoin on an exchange, you don't really know what to do next, and you want somebody to help you select a wallet and set it up and play around with some transactions. Really, any questions that you have technically with how to buy, secure, and store Bitcoin, you can also schedule a call with me on there, and I can link that in the notes as well.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jake.